108.
Meeting call to order 108.
Let's see, did we have any?
We've got our public comment coming in now, maybe.
Do you ladies have any comments you'd like to make before the meeting?
I have a question while we're doing this. What is our Wi-Fi? Is it Clark County Gas or is it Clark County or?
Clark County Gas.
No, who did you want to say anything?
That public comment at this point.
Yes, I don't think you have access to it.
Oh, okay.
We have to request it in advance.
Yes.
I gotcha. Well, that's what I was just reading, so I'm like.
We'll try to make that a regular part of this.
Did they take out Clearwater?
Clearwater?
Yes, oh yeah, that's what I'm gonna, or to the county system now.
And I assume.
Wayne came up.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Okay, so it looks like we don't have any public comment at this point. Let's start out with roll call and let's reverse it today and start with Adam.
Adam, are you good? Ab?
John Spencer, Ab.
Jean Akers, Conservation Techniques.
Pat Lee, Clark County Environmental Services.
Barbara Anderson, Pam.
Jennifer Halleck, Vancouver Public Schools.
Christian Avery, Schools.
Candidates Paradis, Pam.
Lori Lebowski, Clark County Community Planning.
Leanne Mattis, Clark County Parks.
Bill Murphy, Clark County Parks.
Willie Traub, Assessor's Office.
Pete Van Wartwick, Assessor.
Peter Silva, Oregon County Counselor's Office.
Jerry Pugh, Clark County Parks.
Oh, I got you with your mouthful.
Sue Gibbs, East Mini Haha Neighbors Association.
Linda McGuire, East Mini Haha Neighbors Association.
Jeff Wise, Clark County Public Works.
Welcome, everyone. I think it's a great day. We've got lots of good speakers. So let's just jump right in. Has everyone had an opportunity to review the minutes from our last meeting? Open to a motion to accept.
Move to approve.
So John moves to approve. Do I hear a second?
I'll second it.
Second by Candace. All in favor?
Aye, aye, Cap.
Any opposed? Motion carries. We don't have any unfinished business at this time because give yourself a hand. Woohoo! We have a plan. We have a plan, folks. And I just want to take a minute to thank all of you. I know the extra effort that was put in with all the additional meetings and stuff this past year. And I think it came to fruition. Great job, Lori, on your PowerPoint presentations. Great job addressing the issues of staffing, which is always a hard thing to talk to, Bill. And I think that collectively we did a great job and we're entitled to pat ourselves on the back. So thank you, everyone.
It was really great. Thank you.
So along that lines, next thing on our agenda is the comprehensive plan debrief. And I'm not sure if this is a Lori or a Bill.
It could be you, Barbara, too.
So. Oh, yeah.
It's but I can start off if you like. Of course, the hearing. It was actually the way I felt about the atmosphere of the room is that it was kind of a rebrief of all of the different meetings that we had leading up to it, you know. And so it was. We've been doing this collectively as a group, you know, three or four times before that, and so we kind of brushed it off and went through the process one more time. We had some great public comments that came up, and Barbara, I appreciate you speaking as a presenter, as well as a citizen, that you came up a second time, which I do appreciate that.
I always value that I have two hats, and I'm entitled to that.
Exactly.
Other one.
And of course, you know, we had a lot of public comments that came in, and largely in support of the plan and all the things that we're doing here in Parks. And so I was very pleased at the outcome, and what I was really pleased with was the Planning Commission unanimous vote towards approving the comp plan, as well as the Board of County Councilors that unanimously approved the plan as well. So a great success on everybody's part, and also want to acknowledge Jean Akers for all the work that she has worked on the plan and behind the scenes and making it happen. So thank you so much, Lori. Wonderful job. Thank you for setting up all of our presentations. You did a great job.
Thank you. Yeah, and I'd just like to say that I think if you're doing a post-mortem on it, that I think one of the really strong points, things that we did right, was your recommendations to go forth periodically throughout the process and keep those lines of communications open. I think that's why nothing was a surprise when it got to the end and we were able to address things. So keeping that in mind going forward, that's, I think, a key point to our success.
I think earlier on in our process, and of course, Councillor Medora joined us here, and he gave us the turn the lights on spiel.
Yeah.
And we certainly stepped up the plate and did that. We probably had probably one more work session than what we necessarily had to have, but I think that was in large part our effort to really be get out there and keep them up to date as to what was going on. So when the time came for the hearing, obviously there were really no questions that were of consequence.
And I think that's the idea in the process, that you have enough work sessions, answer the questions, have enough public involvement so that when you do have the hearing, it's just a presentation and deliberation and opportunity for public comment.
Anyone else have something to add on that?
I just know it's not easy to go through all those processes and all those steps and all the right timing, and so thanks for making sure we didn't have any missteps and that everything went smoothly. There's a lot of coordination behind the scenes that happened with that. So,
and it doesn't always happen with everybody.
It is very difficult to do. So.
Well, impressed me is when we started this process, we were a brand new Parks Department, and we had a brand new Parks Advisory Board, and so, I mean, essentially the next month after we formed as a board was when we started working on this, and so we did a lot of work in a year's time, and I'm really proud of everybody, especially all the extra meetings that we took, particularly the work on the comp plan. These were long meetings, four-hour-long meetings that we had, and so with any luck, we won't have to have anything quite so grueling in the future until, you know, this next one rolls around.
So did you want to address the next steps? Is this where you wanted to talk to us about the two parks that are coming up, or is that
I think the next steps is that regarding the plan itself, I believe, and that's kind of the...
That was your add to the agenda, so I'm not sure.
Laurie and Gina, if you want to speak to the next steps of the comp plan.
So you now have a plan that's adopted. There are a series of recommendations in that plan. I don't have anything prepared, by the way. So. And several of those lead into what you're doing next, being giving consideration to what projects are moving forward in your six-year plan, what's your priority, how are you going to fund those when you don't have adequate funding to actually implement the six-year plan, considerable amount in terms of revenues and expenses. There's a big gap. So how are you going to attack that gap? How are you going to prioritize? And I think one of the items on your agenda today is looking at prioritizing which grant submittals or grant applications you're going to chase or have the staff chase. So there's a lot of follow-up. And one of the big recommendations that came out of this that seemed to me was one of your most important priorities, at least in what I heard in the communications, was leveraging everything with partnerships. So now we have schools at the table, we have other county offices at the table. There are other organizations, neighborhood organizations, et cetera, where you're gonna wanna be as proactive as possible, wearing one of your hats as a PAB member to capture some of the value of leveraging those partnerships. And that's really a lot of your boots on the ground work. I mean, park staff can try, but as we already know, is one of the recommendations, the park staff needs more capacity. So for them to be tackling this plan is going to be pretty tough if they do it on their own. So while it's very celebratory and congratulatory and wow, we got this endorsed, which is really a good plan, there's still a lot of work to happen. It doesn't mean no more of these kinds of meetings in terms of extra meetings and stuff, but getting out there and fostering the implementation is going to be big. So that would be my general comment for next steps.
So I have a question. Probably a Gene Bill Gene question is the intent of this. What are we, a board? This
advisory board.
Advisory board isn't really to pick the projects that we do, though. Is that true, Bill? It's sort of what's coming under. Aren't you guys going to bring forward to us what it is that seems right?
So what we're talking about today is was as we we've picked the staff, we've picked the projects out that are in the identified in the 2016 plan. And then obviously we have about 9 projects that we've identified that I brought up at our last meeting. And of course we can't go after all those projects for grant funding. We don't want to be the hogs at the trough, so to speak. And so I would like a recommendation from this board to see what three to four projects are your priorities, you know, so we have some direction from this board, you know, what your preferences are, and that helps guide us to choose those projects going forward. So we always rely on your expertise and your knowledge as a board, you know, to help guide us. So that is the purpose.
But so, we've got things to consider, like expiring gifts that drive it, or a specific neighborhood that has a greater need for a park.
Right, yes.
So there are facts and data that will contribute to not just our interpretation and bringing and helping set those priorities.
Yeah. Sure, and I'll be talking about those projects today.
What I'm really getting at is we want to be able to support
yes.
the functions of the parks board in congruence with what we're hearing in the community about what's needed, not necessarily to drive the work.
And believe me, I do appreciate all your support. So it's nice to know that I'm not working alone in a vacuum. So, you know, having all of our Parks Advisory Board members here, you know, gives us that broad spectrum approach to taking a look at a single issue.
So just a question. We don't know what the matching funds, do you have any approved matching funds for grants here, or are you going to try to put that on the budget for next year?
We do have some matching funds, and that is our okay. park impact fee funds.
Okay.
Those we know we have,
okay.
but that is essentially it for right now.
Okay.
The rest, we've got some decision packages going forward for consideration this fall, actually this winter, by the Board of County Councilors. And I think, in fact, I talked about that at our last meeting, and this advisory board took them one by one and approved them, so I thank you for your support on that. And so that can be considered matching funds. So if we're looking at real estate excise tax monies coming our way, that would definitely be used towards projects.
Well, I just know, like, what we asked for probably, and realistically, we probably won't get, because that's usually how it goes.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, because in my past, we've went out for grants. Well, it doesn't do any good if you don't have matching funds.
That's right.
So that's the other thing I think we need to just make sure we kind of keep in the mirror that we're not asking for something and we know that we're not going to ever get the matching funds.
One of the very first steps that we have to take when we go after a grant is we need to seek a Board of County Councilor resolution, mm-hmm. which indicates their political and financial support
okay.
to help us match those funds.
Okay.
So then it's kind of up to them to try to find that money and get it to us.
Get it. Okay.
But if we can't get a resolution approved, then that grant is pretty much off the table because we have no other avenue of matching funds.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, the other big component that I see stepping up are the various volunteer groups, either through Karen or through the neighborhood associations and such, because those volunteer hours can be used to leverage as matching
yes.
funds.
There's in-kind.
And all we need is just the in-kind.
Right.
We just need the agreement with them in order to demonstrate that we've got that commitment.
And one other avenue that Gene kind of brought up earlier is that, you know, we're looking for private funding as well. And there's a lot of folks out there who are willing to help. In fact, I've got some meetings coming up in the near future with folks that have money and want to see projects move forward. So that is an avenue that we can approach. And that's, of course, I'm going to be relying on our Parks Advisory Board to do some outreach to try to, you know, help us bring some of these projects together. Oh, sorry. Okay. I'll do my best to try to speak a little louder. I got a cold, so I'm a little bit hoarse today. So
we're all fighting gravelly voices.
With regard to some of the next steps in the more immediate future, of course, Gene has made all the revisions to the Gene and Lori both have made some revisions to the final document, and that should be coming out in the next few weeks, I understand.
Yeah.
Once that happens, I will make a final copy of the PROS plan and distribute that out to folks. I plan to make about 120 copies, so we should have plenty to go around.
I just want to add that Leanne was a big help with revising the plan.
We couldn't make it without her.
Yeah.
She takes good care of us.
I probably wouldn't be employed without her. So.
We're a team.
Super. Thanks. It looks like we've got still a lot of work ahead of us. Exciting work, though. Under new business, I know I've been looking forward to these presentations. So the levy presentation is next, so I will turn it over to Willie Trump.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. Thank you, everyone, for having me over here.
Sorry about that, not to interrupt, but we just want to say Jean has to go really soon. So on number C there, should we say our goodbyes to?
Oh, I'm sorry. I did not mean to skip over that.
She was not going to let you go.
Absolutely. Sorry. Thanks for calling me on that.
Sure. But I just want to take a moment and thank both Lori and Jean. They are basically our hired consultants that have kind of hand-walked us through this entire process. And I certainly appreciate all the effort and time that they put into this. And unfortunately, we ran out of money, so we can't retain them, at least not until we get some more funding for this upcoming year. So, but I sincerely do appreciate all the professionalism that you've presented to us and all the presentations from Jean, all the background work, all the research that you've done and putting this together and kind of being the guide that really helped us go through, because that was essentially a baby going into this comprehensive planning process. It was my first one, and so Jean did a wonderful job. So, Lori, you came on basically at the beginning of the year, and boy, I can really tell when you kick it into gear, you really made a huge difference. And you provided such a great momentum and getting us set up for all these meetings and really guided us through that. So thank you so much for all your help. I look forward to working with both of you in the future. And so you guys are a valued commodity to us, and we don't want to let you go.
Yeah. And we'll be talking, my boss Oliver will be talking with you, and so hopefully I can continue to help out with some.
I would hope so. That would be wonderful.
That'd be great. That's continuity of maintaining the same knowledge base is important.
Absolutely.
So we don't have to start over again.
And on the one thing, with regard to Jean's expertise, we are hoping to get a grant writer on staff and a planner person. And even if we are very successful and we are awarded that position, this fall, it's going to take a while for that position to get up to speed. Yes. And so I might need some consultant help, if you will, to try to steer us through this grant cycle, through March 1st when all the grants are due. So there might be a chance here when I might be retraining Jean for that purpose. So we also do have some internal help downtown. We do have some folks that have got some grant experience which are willing to help us out as well. So I don't think we're going to be in too dire straits, in this upcoming grant process. So we should be in pretty good shape.
Well, at least we're going to get on board this year.
Yes, we are going to be on board, and we are eligible, which is a huge victory for us.
Yes.
And so, saying that, Leanne went through the trouble of buying celebratory cupcakes for everybody. So please help yourself.
I just thought assessment was so exciting.
I am excited to hear these presentations. So, thanks for coming. And we hope to see you again soon. So back to you, Willie.
That's fine. It's fine. I'm the levy specialist for the assessor's office in Clark County. I've been with the office since August of 2012, and sitting next to me is Peter, the assessor for Clark County. So we like to go together when we're visiting various boards and districts so that I can talk about the technical stuff and he can talk about the political stuff. So it works out pretty well.
Go Storm.
Mm-hmm.
political stuff. Go Skyview Storm.
So it sounds like the advisory board's been around for about a year or so. Is that what I'm understanding?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll provide a little bit of history then for the parks levy itself. Probably what prompted the meeting was back in 2013, one of the levy limits was hit, which triggered a process called pro-rationing, and that significantly reduced the levy for the Parks District for that one year, 2013. So that's what this particular presentation is oriented towards, is one of the six levy limits that need to be calculated against the parks levy each year. So just as a quick summary to get it out of the way, the aggregate levy limit for 2016 is very likely not to be hit. And that has to do with the relationship between property values and the levy rates. They're inversely related, and so and the aggregate limit is an operative on the levy rate. And so the higher the rates go, the closer you get to the limit. However, property values are going up significantly, so that pushes the rates down and pushes you farther away from the levy limit. And that's even with the Fire District Number 6 putting forth a ballot measure to lift their levy limit, levy lid lift, I should say. Okay, so.
What is the amount that Fire District 6, I've seen that in the community, I wondered how that would affect parks.
They're proposing a levy lid lift, which will increase their levy rate by about 23 cents this year. It'll actually be less because we rely mostly on last year's numbers. And effectively, it should have no impact on the Parks District unless I get very surprised by the behavior of all of the other districts that are involved in this limit calculation. And that would be pretty extreme. We're seeing property values increase by 10% last year and around 6.4% this year. And those are pretty considerable increases, and it really does drop the chance of hitting that limit down pretty low. So from a global perspective, and I'm going to apologize in advance because I'm going to bust out a little bit of algebra to help me explain. So I will try to contain my enthusiasm. I really do like algebra, so probably pretty good for this job. So the colored portion here is the core property tax formula. This is the formula that lies at the center of what the assessor's office does for the county and all of the taxing districts in the county. The formula is taxable assessed value divided by 1,000 multiplied by the levy rate equals the levy amount. This formula holds true both on a district-wide level and also on an individual home level. So you can apply this basically at any scale, and it'll hold true all the way throughout. As you can see, I've included in the handout a table that talks about the sources of the various portions of the property tax formula and also the limits that operate on them. For instance, in the levy rate, you can see that the aggregate limit is a collective limit, which means that multiple districts are involved in the limit calculation, the Parks District being one of them. But not all of the districts, because while it's tax law, it has to be complicated. So. All right. You can kind of think of this particular formula, if any of you are familiar with accounting practices, there's the assets plus liability, or assets equals liabilities plus owner's equity. That lies at the center of the accounting profession's work. This lies at the center of our work. For the taxable assessed value, that the green portion, that's driven by market forces and then appraised by the appraisers that Peter's office has on staff. We appraise both residential property and commercial property, and there are a whole bunch of laws about how to complete that appraisal, including the statistical methods we must follow, and then also physical re-evaluation once every 6 years for each property in the county. The levy amounts, the red portion of the formula, are provided by the tax districts themselves. In the situation of the Parks District, I believe the Board of County Councilors are also the commissioners for the Parks District, so they're the ones who would communicate to our office what the levy amounts they'd like to impose on their district would be. There are several limits that are imposed upon the district in this particular area, including the highest lawful levy since 1986. That one's a fun one to calculate. The 1% increase limit, which is basically a cap on how much it can grow from year to year, and then the budget limit, which is just simply the budget for the district itself. And then finally, the blue area is the levy rate. That's my job. I use the levy rate to balance the property tax formula each year. So obviously the green portion is going to fluctuate with market forces. Right now it's going up pretty fast. Levy amounts are also going up, but they're capped by 1%. So if you're starting to kind of get a feel, you can see that the only place the formula can give right now is levy rates, which drop in order to make sure that the formula balances out.
And the fire district 6 imposes a levy?
Fire district 6 imposes its own levy, and it is one of the levies that are added together in order to calculate the aggregate limit. So in a recovering economy, we'll see the property tax values go up and the levy rate go down, which is influenced by which impacts the levy rate. And then in a struggling economy, which is what we saw back in the Great Recession, property tax values were dropping, and a lot of the limits that are involved with the levy rate were being hit, including the aggregate limit and also the statutory maximum rate limit for a lot of districts. The statutory maximum rate limit for the Parks District by law can be as high as 75 cents per $1,000 of assessed value, but at the formation of the Parks District, the ballot measure specified that its maximum would be 27 cents. So it would take another ballot measure in order to adjust the maximum any higher than that.
We currently are running at 23, or are we at full 27?
23.
I don't have that memorized. So to calculate the aggregate limit, just to kind of give a very brief overview, what we do is we monitor the district, each of the rates of the districts that are involved in the aggregate limit. What that means is that we basically have to wait for the districts to make their choices. They get an opportunity to say, I want a full 1% growth in my levy amount. They could say, I don't want that, I want a 0.5%. Or they could even say, I want less levy than I had last year, though that's pretty rare. Once we've got each of the rates from all of the districts gathered together, what we do is we look at areas, each area in the county where the districts overlap in a unique fashion. We call those tax code areas, and we have those defined. One of the reasons we have those defined is very specifically to calculate this limit. So we'll look at the unique overlap of those districts, the rates that they each impose, and see if it adds up to that $5.90, which is the aggregate limit rate. If it adds up to $5.90, it triggers the pro-rationing process. And what that essentially does is it rations out what levy rates there are available to the various districts. There's an elaborate and complicated set of laws that prioritize the different taxing districts. So for instance, top priority would be the county. Next in line is typically the fire districts, and the parks districts end up being, with all the levies that we have in the county, the parks district is right at the bottom. So that's why in 2013, the parks district was hit with pro-rationing. It's because when you run out of that $5.90 to distribute, then first people who get hit would be parks and the cemetery districts.
So, well. Willie, just for clarification's sake, since we are at the bottom of the junior levies, if you will, and we had an extreme pro-rationing scenario, could the parks levy be depleted all the way down to zero before the next higher levy is affected?
That's one of the harsh things about the aggregate limit, is it can completely eliminate a levy for a year. So when you're in an instance where property values are dropping as rapidly as they were in the Great Recession, it could end up being where districts lose their levy completely.
So our protection would be to ask for the protection of the levy, of the millage rate of the levy, and that would require a vote of the public to make that happen, correct?
Actually, there are laws written into the property tax levy laws which allow districts to opt to protect a portion of their levy from pro-rationing. Fire districts universally all do that in order to protect a portion of their levy. However, the Parks District doesn't have the opportunity to do it, as far as I understand. because the law that forms the ability for parks districts to form specifies that the county must have a population of 1.5 million before you'll have the opportunity to protect any levy from barrage. So I can send you that law.
Do parks go at least one above cemetery?
Cemetery and parks are on the same level, so. There's still other districts that are even lower than that, but they don't exist in Clark County. So.
I guess the easier your discomfort with that, the property values started falling in 2007, and we didn't hit pro rationing till 2012. And the actual request that, you know, the levy amount is actually dollar amounts that the, you know, the districts are asking, and it doesn't, you know, go up that great. So we have greatly increasing property values like what we are now, and lots of new construction. The chances of, say, in an economy like we're in right now, of hitting that limit, isn't that great? You'd probably even see a few years of property values falling before we go back to hitting the pro ration. I mean, all those years, it took 5 years of declining property values to hit the pro ration. So something we're too concerned about.
So from another angle, when we did hit pro rationing, was the chunk that we missed out on banked? In other words, can we go back for that, or is it gone?
Oh, spent by other districts.
That's a really interesting question. Bank capacity is calculated for districts each year, so it's recalculated, and it has to do with the distance between the highest lawful levy limit and the actual amount that was levied. And so
we levied the full amount we could, but we didn't get it, so it's
yeah. And so the pro rationing doesn't actually impact the highest lawful levy limit, and so that means you did bank the capacity. Technically, it was also used up to restore the levy back to its original form in the following year.
So when we hit the bottom in 2012, like a lot of the fire districts, they were at their levy limit, the 150, right? So they were getting a chunk of money out every year. So as they started going back up, they were still able to basically, even though values were going up, get to the 150. And what you're seeing in the fire district is at 6. Now all of a sudden the values have increased enough that their levy limit or their levy rate is so much less than the $1.50 that they're wanting their to go back to the 150. And actually, I think they're asking, we figured out like a 27% increase in their budget or something to get back to the 150 based upon the numbers that we.
And what happens when you go to the voters and ask for a lid lift is it short circuits the limits that operate on property tax formula and forces the levy rate to a particular amount. And so that allows the growth rate to be much higher than 1% in a given year. Another aspect about the aggregate levy limit that makes it pretty harsh is that each one of those unique areas where the different levies overlap has to be individually calculated to find if it hits that $5.90 limit. So even if one corner of the district goes over $5.90, the Washington State Constitution says that levy rates must be consistent throughout the entire district. So you could see the Parks District be rationed 16 cents instead of 27 cents in just one tiny corner of the district, and it would force the whole rest of the district to follow suit and go down to 16 cents. That's essentially what happened in 2013, is that it must be uniform in order to ensure fairness. One of the things that not a lot of districts know, though, is that once this information is out and available to the taxing districts, they have an option to approach the other taxing districts that are levying in that one particular area and say, hey, if you want to, let's have you lower your rate by 3 cents, and then we'll gain our full levy back, and then we'll pay you for the amount that you lost. That's actually permissible in the law to to finagle.
I haven't did that before.
It was not really an option because of how the recession was going. It was very harsh. No one was going to make those, and we were pretty far over the $5.90. That's why we saw the 27 cents go down to the 16 cents. You're not going to get a lot of districts willing to give up that much. You'd have to get a lot of people on board in a very short time.
So what does it do when a district like Fire District 6 raise their lid? How does that, I mean, does that then call out that district as potentially affecting then all the other districts across the county, or no?
Not generally in this sort of environment. Okay. There'd probably be some more consternation if it was still a struggling economy. But then again, you kind of have to think the commissioners probably aren't going to be very well inclined to raise their limit in a struggling economy. That's a pretty hard narrative to sell to their constituents. Not to say it doesn't happen, but it would be difficult. Okay. I'll just say one last thing, and that's when I say very likely no, I want to say definitely not. But we don't get the information from all the taxing districts until later in the year. And in the aggregate limit itself, there are 27 other levies that need to be calculated and 328 unique tax code areas where those levies overlap. So the calculations are complex, and trying to predict the behavior of all of those other taxing districts is really difficult. So we say very likely no instead of definitely no, just in case. That pretty much covers my stuff.
Thank you, Peter. Appreciate the presentation.
And if anyone has any questions in the future, feel free to reach out to me. I very much like answering questions about levies, so you'll be making my day if you ask me.
So, okay, so this is levies. Schools levy and bond. Do we do any options for bonds within certain districts as a park or any of that? Do we have that opportunity?
That's a good question. I'm not very well versed on the individual laws that enable districts to make different types of levies, so that would probably be something that you'd need to research.
Well, one of the things is, you know, when you go out and you approve the levy for the school districts, in the Constitution, there's the 1% limit, which is basically $10 per thousand under the Constitution, which is where the 590 comes from. It's the county's portion of the $1. Voter approved can go above and beyond, and basically school district levies, that's what they are. And actuality is when you pass a levy or you pass a bond for a school district, you're actually asking for a certain dollar amount every year, and then basically, if the voters approve that, then the levy rate's calculated based upon that. So it's different because it's the voter approved above the 1% constitutional limit.
The law is configured differently depending on how often the taxpayers are approached. For like fire districts and the park district, you approach them once at the formation of the district. And then again, if you need to make adjustments to various aspects of your levy. But these limits are in place for districts of that nature, where they go and are established and then they continue on. Then these limits act on the growth of the levy over time. For school districts, they have to approach again and again and again, which means they're getting direct approval from the taxpayer to say, you may impose this levy upon me. And that short circuits every one of these limits.
When you say short circuit, it adversely can affect?
No, it prevents them from being applied effectively. There is, I am aware, tangentially, of some limits that do apply to the school districts, but those are exclusively calculated by the ESD 112 in Clark County.
So. Now, wasn't it a bond that we did on the Metro bond for our maintenance, where we willingly voted to maintain our parks through additional... Wasn't that classified
that was
as a bond?
That was the initial levy. It was not a bond.
It was a levy. It was not a bond.
Correct.
So what I'm thinking of is if there's a particular district, so you all want another park really badly, but you can't get Bill to build you one, can your district go bond against
So the
future
the,
development and growth to build your thing now.
Well, the answer, if I can jump in there, you're thinking like a school district where you pass a bond levy.
Well,
in other words, you bond it and it's paid for by an additional levy to pay it.
Yeah.
In our case, as a in a park district, you can't pass an additional bond levy.
Okay.
All you would do is you would bond on your current levy. So yes, we could do a bond, but we'd have to, you know, axe our maintenance program in order to pay for it.
I see.
So.
Yeah,
and I guess my question comes from the term that's been applied to it, which is the GCPD or whatever, Metro Bond, is what term I have heard applied to that very frequently.
Well,
and that's why I thought it was a bond. But and that's where I'm trying to get educated here. Getting
And just for the difference between school district, like the levy, and I'll use the battleground school district for example, right? Had the battleground school district gone away, right, their levy would not have been collected from the taxpayers for the next years, even though they approved, because they didn't approve the new levy. But their bond levy, even if the district went away, would continue to apply because they were collecting the money that was basically paying off a debt. So when the levy is to collect a debt that the district's done, that continues to be collected whether that district is there or not until it's paid off. So.
Now what we could do is we could start charging parking fees and run a revenue on a parking
fee.
Right.
Thank you so much. That was really educational.
Well, thank you for having me. That was good.
Yeah.
Thank you, Willie. Thank you, Peter.
So the next is discussion about surplus of land. Peter Sillman.
Thank you for the invitation to come.
Thanks for coming.
I understand surplusing property is a concern of the Parks Board, and I'd like to cover three subjects. One is the Pearson property, which is probably what triggered this discussion, and then maybe talk about just the county properties in general, what there is and isn't out there, and the process for selecting or surplusing county properties. So to start with, anybody who doesn't know, the Pearson property is this proposed surplus property identified up here. This was declared surplus by the county commissioners earlier this year. And the reason this is controversial is because it was purchased in the mid-90s using Conservation Futures money. It was part of the Lewis River Greenway properties. But yet it was selected to be removed out of that and surplus. So there's naturally some concern. Is this a trend? How do we select that? Why was this property singled out? To put it in a little bit of context, probably the number one reason this property was surplus or identified is because it actually has a residence on it. And one of the philosophical things at the county councilors is they don't want to be in the landlord business. And our current county policy says, you know, if we have properties that are for county purposes, we should retain them. But if there isn't a county purpose for it, then we should surplus it. And so this one being a residence kind of got put on the radar because of that. And they said, why are we in the landlord business? So that's probably how it got at least some kind of a bullseye put on it for examination. There was also some particular circumstances about how this was purchased, and there was a particular memorialization of a board meeting, and even in one of the staff reports when we purchased the property indicated at that time it was proposed that we surplus or sell the property that had the residence on it. Now to put this in context, this was in the mid-90s too, and we had just adopted our new comprehensive plan, and perhaps they thought maybe the zoning in the future would change to a lower zoning, and they would only sell the part that has the residence on it. But this is an Ag 20 property, and in 20 years the zoning hasn't changed. So maybe there was a different vision for how much we would surplus or get rid of in the future. But when it came down to it, the county commissioners didn't feel that we should be owning a property that was basically where we were the landlord for it. And there were a couple other weaknesses to keeping this property that were identified. If you want to go to the next slide.
So is it a house and a residence and they rent it from the...
Yeah, so it's a house on 20 acres and they rent it out. I think they have some horses out in the field, things like that. I think you get $1,900 a month rent for it. But one of their concerns was, what this is a map of habitat and sensitive areas. And you can see our property isn't within the habitat area or that buffer from the Lewis River. And so we're not preserving habitat by keeping this. One of the objectives of the Conservation Futures Program is to purchase that habitat area and preserve those areas for future enjoyment and low impact uses of the public. And the county commissioners certainly don't object to that, but there's still plenty of room for a trail in the habitat area, and even if we didn't retain that property. In addition, we've had this property for 20 years and there was no concept or plan produced in 20 years that said this should be a future regional park or something like that. So that was another thing that figured into the mix. And the next slide gives you a little bit more context to the area. So this property is very close to the existing state park at Paradise Point. We have another property identified near the La Center Road. There's like 26 acres there that is a future park. And all the other highlighted areas are publicly owned property. Most of it's been purchased through Conservation Futures for preservation and low impact uses. And then we have our other regional parks, Daybreak, Louisville, and the future Daybreak property as well. So that's how it kind of fits into the mix of our future regional parks. Put that in context. So it was felt that getting rid of this property, getting us out of the landlord business, we wouldn't be hindering the future development of trails along the river. We're not abandoning sensitive areas or habitat that we should be preserving. And there was no identified hard future need identified for retaining that property. So I think the counselors balanced all that out and eventually decided to go ahead and surplus that. Pat Lee is here, and he can actually talk afterwards about surplusing that property and what we're going to do with those funds, because it was purchased with Conservation Futures and a state grant. It has to be reused for that same purpose. So we're not taking it out of that department and using it for something else. It'll stay in that. And I don't want to get too much into that since Pat's...
Who bought the property? Well, did they have a master plan, or was there
a concept similar to the first slide, which kind of showed proposed future trails. Most of the area that was purchased was habitat area. Another thing to put this in context, this was one of three parcels that were purchased by the same owner. And I think the owner wanted to make it a package deal, all or nothing. So that was another thing. So Pat could probably go into more specifics about maybe the history of the property or how we funded it or things like that if you'd like.
Well, I mean, just we surplused it, so who bought it from us?
Well, we've declared it surplus, but there's a process we have to go through to do that. And Pat's going to talk about that specifically. So it hasn't been sold yet.
I see.
So, and I see we have some questions in the back.
Yeah, I did. So when you surplus property, that means that you can sell it on the open market?
Yes, when the county declares property surplus, the county counselors do that, and they're basically telling staff, we agree that this is not something that we want to retain permanently as part of the county, and they're basically giving the staff permission to sell it through
an agreement. So if it's... Once they get permission to sell it, they put it on the open market and advertise it for sale so that anybody can bid on it, or do they already have somebody that wants it?
Not always.
No, it's always put out in a competitive bid. Usually it goes through an auction company, so everybody can have access to bid on that.
And the bidding starts at a reasonable level.
They usually do some kind of assessment of the property's value and decide what the minimum amount they would accept for that is. Does that answer your question?
Are there a lot of residences around there? That's kind of...
No, there's not a lot of residents out there. No.
It's all farm field.
Yeah. Well, it's AG 20, right?
Yeah, it's Ag 20, so it's mostly large lots, and it hasn't been developed a lot in that specific area. So, and you had a question?
Yes, that 20 acres you're referring to, is it surrounded by private property, or is it surrounded by county-owned property,
You can see the shaded properties are pretty much county-owned properties. So all the ones towards the river from that are county-owned.
So it's sort of surrounded by county property?
Yeah, so the north side would be county-owned property, and then the other ones closer towards the road would be private.
I find it interesting that a single home is the driving force of this, when possibly that property could level the house and make that a beautiful parkland. Has this nice scenic view of the river. It's not at river level. It's up nice. It would make a wonderful place for 20 million dollar homes up there that the county would get a lot of cash from. But I think there's also a future to it, the opportunity to serve the general public to have a wonderful picnic area or park area that can be used by the general public. And what is the county's response to just leveling it and making it a park?
Well, I think that option was weighed or brought up in their deliberations, but I think the weakness was we've had it for 20 years and nobody's proposed that it would be a future park or developed any concept plans or shown that there's a need for an additional regional park in that area.
And does that same attitude then prevail over other park or potential parks in the county that haven't been developed and that the county can take the same approach on?
Well, again, this individual lot was not a proposed future. Yes, well, it does have a house on it, again, which makes it the weakness of the argument or what brought it to their attention. But there is a lot of land between this parcel and the river, so there's room for picnic tables, parking, a restroom. It's just not going to be a huge area.
I visited the area, based upon my visual look at the area. If I'm sitting up here having a picnic and looking down at the river, it's a much different perspective and a less enjoyable perspective than more enjoyable than if I'm down at the river level. It's a different perspective, and it's like saying I will walk in the house, but you want to do that, you walk in the valleys. You've got a different perspective. So I think
And your other concern was redevelopment or building a big house. Well, it is on one house per 20 acres, and it has an existing house, so somebody will either use the existing house or they could potentially remodel it or build a larger house there.
And I guess I have one follow-up question, would be how much influence in our neighborhood we have a park, and that park is legitimately within a half mile of lots of neighbors. The fact that it has one entrance over here, the person on the other side has to go out 2 miles around to get there, because the neighbors over there didn't want to allow access. That's my understanding. So given that you build a million-dollar home up there, because it's a gorgeous, it's a really gorgeous spot, I have to admit, I'd love to have a home there and have that view. Could I not then take the same perspective? I don't want people driving past me. I don't want them having parties down there. I don't want any the use of that property.
Well, and this doesn't kind of fit the model of a neighborhood park because there's not a lot of residences down there, but there is a public right-of-way that goes all the way down to the river currently, so there's no chance that private parties could restrict the public's access down there. Hopefully that answers your question.
Well, they have to drive past their house,
Well, again, they can't shut a public road because people don't like driving past their house.
So she had another question that I didn't quite get the answer to, is the county has lots of other long-term undeveloped properties.
Okay.
Is there a trend or a policy getting started here that says if we don't develop a property within 20 years, it's surplus?
And short answer is no. And the only reason this one got singled out is because it's a residence and the county is in the landlord business because of it. But there is no other property curve this would build and there's no other parks property where we have a plan or something set in motion or any other of the other legacy lands properties where we've purchased habitat. There's no other properties that we've identified that would be surplus, and it's not the intention to start a trend in that direction for parks or habitat areas where we have future trails plans to surplus those either.
So are there other properties, regardless of whether they're park zoned, that have, where in the county's a landlord, that they're going to be surplusing as well?
Okay, well, let me just get into a little bit of overview of the county's properties then, since we're leading into
could
that.
Could I just ask one question before we move along that direction,
sure.
Please? Along the thought of dollars and cents, it's my understanding that this piece of property is encumbered with the grants that need to be repaid. You certainly can't find a like piece of property to save your soul to that one. And also the conservation futures. There's plenty of conservation future dollars available if we wanted to pick up these additional properties down there that could be leveraged. So we really don't need the monies from this piece to do that. That's a separate issue in my mind.
Well, I think Bill will get into it, but we're not looking at repaying the grants. We would be looking to exchange, sell this property and buy one that the original grant application.
Yeah, I'll speak to the grant requirements and the process that we have to go through.
Yeah. And he'll do that as soon as I'm done.
Okay. Yeah, and then just one other point, and that is, you know, I know that in our park district that 20 years ago, if we had secured some lands up here, we wouldn't have the issues we have now. Trying to locate, now that we have the money to purchase some land, there is no parkland to be found to save our soul. And so I think that that's why we hear such a strong voice of people wanting to protect the lands that we've already secured and held on to for 20 years. I think there's some validity to that.
I completely understand that.
Yeah.
But I want to assure you, you know, making a decision like this, it certainly wasn't made on the drop of a dime. It was talked about informally between the councilors for several months. It was brought up formally during their board time discussions on multiple occasions. Staff was asked to produce a report. It was brought up in a public hearing for everybody to give input. Mm-hmm. So it certainly wasn't taken lightly.
Yeah. And that's where I think we've been hearing a lot from our public too.
And definitely, you know, the encouragement from the board is, you know, let's go find another property that fits with the overall trail plan so we can further that plan and use the funds more effectively in their minds. So,
can we use the sale of that property to develop some of that trail?
I believe it's for the purchase of property, but not for the development of trails. That's correct.
But, Pat, I have a question. Can you build trails? Because I was looking at the one map, if you go back. Let's see, one more. So it looks like it's in the habitat, the trails in the habitat.
Yeah, I worry about that same thing.
I mean, certainly you can build trails. You know, it may limit the cross-section, or it may trigger additional mitigation requirements, which is then going to make the trail cost more to develop. It's not that it's prohibited. It's just more of a cost question than anything else.
Okay.
So let me just talk about county properties in general. When they were looking at where are we the land, are we really the landlord in Clark County? The reality is we're only in maybe a handful of situations. One was this one. Another one was identified at the Dolly Building. It was also declared surplus this year. That was an office building in downtown that used to be county offices. The county's retained that for, I believe, over 13 years now, where it's not primarily county offices. And they decided, once again, we don't want to be in the landlord business. Let's declare that surplus. If we sell it or when we sell it, we can use that to pay down debt, pay for one-time expenses, or use it some other way that's a little bit more related to county business. But again, that idea conforms more to their policy that we should be buying county property for county purposes and we shouldn't be in the landlord business. So that kind of follows that model. And I think there's only a handful of other cases where we are a landlord. I think one is near the future Daybreak Park. I think there's another small residence there that we rent out. But because that's obviously, you know, master plan for a future park, there's no intention to sell that. And I think maybe there's even a plan to make that a caretaker's residence or something in the future.
Question for you.
Hey, yes.
Hey, Bill, is it possible to, because we have this new proposal or this new comprehensive plan, which we previously had not had, would this new plan have any influence about this property? Like hypothetically, yeah, it's surplus. Now, is it a possibility to revert that back? I'm just curious, because I don't know how things work.
It's not identified specifically. In the comp plan, we do show that we intend to put a trail system, acquire more property along that greenway system, and then eventually build a trail corridor through that system. So, but no, I don't think there's any reversionary rights that are affiliated with the comp plan itself.
So let me just throw out some numbers for you to put this in context of what the county does own, because I even had somebody come through the hallway the other day and say, hey, we'd really love to have some of that surplus property you have so we can use it for the homeless or something very worthwhile like that. I'm just like, I'm not aware of any that would suit those needs. We don't have a bunch of warehouses that are empty or anything of that nature, or office buildings, generally speaking. So our biggest landholders are the Parks Department, which owns, I don't know if you have any idea, over 100 individual parcels. But another one of our biggest landowners is the Department of Environmental Services. So when you think about each of these subdivisions getting developed and they have a stormwater facility, those get dedicated to the county, and that becomes a parcel that the county owns through the Department of Environmental Services. They literally own hundreds of those that they have to maintain and keep
track
of.
Will they be surplusing those pieces of property?
They've actually identified a select few that they own for maybe that purpose that never got developed, that we can surplus those in a few cases where it never worked out, or
let's do that.
We do that. But generally, once it's developed as a stormwater facility, we actually maintain that.
This is just a learning thing for me. When you guys have surplus properties, this one wouldn't fit it, but do you ever offer it to fair housing to be developed as affordable housing units?
I don't know if we do to fair housing, but I do know that we go through county departments, and there's kind of an informal process saying, hey, do you have a need for this in your department, just to double check before it's brought to the board for decision, and I can talk about the process in a minute too.
And then one other, the conservation, is there like a list out there of the properties that were bought with that money? That, because one of your points was, is nobody's came and said, hey, we want to make a park on this. Mm-hmm. Was, and I'm kind of new, but was everybody aware that was even there?
And
was
that's
there
a very
option?
Good question, because a lot of these properties aren't really out there. There's not a lot of high visibility to them because we haven't developed them and even produced a minimal amount of public access for them. And a little frustrating on my part, but maybe if there was more visibility over the last 20 years to the county having these, then maybe we would have developed some more plans. I think that's what you're saying.
So is there a list somewhere that is published that, like, for example, us as a board that we could get? And
you can actually go to our county website, and on the bottom right corner where it says a grid, there's also a transparency page. So we have a page that has a bunch of financial reports, but there's also some links there to the GIS page that will show you in color, if you want to look on the map, which departments does the county hold property under. And you can even get an Excel spreadsheet from those links that you can download, and it'll identify every property and who retains it, who at the county is managing that property, what it's for.
Is that layer still there? Because I know I was talking with Brian recently, because I was looking for, well, two different maps. One, the crime map that used to be out there, and the other was the wetland habitat indicator, you know, similar to what you had up there, trying to determine at what point wetlands were in that Sorensen thing that Mulata was talking about. And I didn't find either of those layers available on the GIS.
Okay.
And he says it's under development now. They're
Did you go to the right and choose layers?
Yeah.
And click?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's what I'm saying, is I called Brian because the way I used to get it was to select the layer. And I pulled up the layers, and there was no layer available to say, show me the wetlands.
I'm sure there is somewhere in there that you can find the wetlands.
Yeah, he says they're rewriting it or something, and
It's there somewhere. I'm sure I can help you find it if you want.
I'd love to, because that is a big question that comes up all the time. I've been there. I've been there lots of times before. I'm here to tell you that little layer is not there.
So to buy something that's conservation land is part of the requirement that it becomes a park or that it becomes wetlands, or I mean, what are kind of the guiding lines that say, okay, this is conservation, we can spend conservation money on buying it?
Pat, you want to address that real quick?
Sure. We do have kind of an overall document called the Conservation Areas Acquisition Plan. You can get it on our site, take a look at that. It identifies where there's high value conservation lands within the county. It identifies where we've secured lands. And when we try to leverage our funds, which we try to do all the time, there are specific grant categories that have specific needs. If you're, and it is our policy, just properties acquired ourselves, that public access is allowed. Now there may be some controls on what activities go on any particular site, but public access is allowed. Access isn't developed in all circumstances, but there's several areas where, you know, pretty readily accessible parcels can be enjoyed by the public. And then if you have a grant that has leveraged your funds, then you also have this state overlay that says it has to be open in perpetuity for public use and recreation consistent with the grant category. So there are those built-in protections on what is the intent? Is it open to the public, et cetera, as we go through the process?
Peter, I know you said, I believe, that there was a hearing on this matter down in county. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Was this matter taken before the neighborhood association out there and have any input in from our feelings of impact for those folks that are going to be in that direct area as well as?
I don't think there was an effort to identify if there was a neighborhood association out there. What's that? I don't think so. Well, this would be a less center. I don't know that there's an active neighborhood association on that side of the
Paradise Point.
It is District 2.
Is it Paradise Point?
Isn't that outside the urban growth boundary?
It is outside the urban growth boundary.
And so there wouldn't be an active.
It is outside the urban growth boundary in that area, so I don't know if there's an active neighborhood association.
There's an active neighborhood group out there.
Yeah, I know there is one north of Less Center. I'm just not sure of the specific neighborhood.
There's a new housing development going in Less Center that's going to be building 390. If there isn't, there will be a.
Yeah, I just pulled a flyer out on the side of the street today.
Peter, would like to suggest that you make an effort to go to that neighborhood association and present the information to them also. I think as a matter of courtesy that they deserve that kind of informational briefing. I would for my neighborhood.
Certainly, appreciate the suggestion. Let me just finish up on county-owned properties here real quick. So the county does own a lot of properties in different departments. One of them is in public works as well. They own properties that they have to purchase for mitigation for road projects. They also own parcels that may end up being remnants because they purchased a property impacted by a road project, and at the culmination of the road project, they end up selling that property. One of the high visibility properties right now that the county owns that's involved in that is the old Miller Paint building at the 139th and 20th. Some of you are familiar with that. The county actually purchased that entire parcel because of their impact. Now they're surplusing and selling that property. So that happens. And I think those are probably the three biggest property owners: Public Works, Parks, and Department of Environmental Services. But there aren't a lot of properties out there. I identified over 100 parcels that we could sell that look like individual properties, but they're really just slivers next to properties. They're not developable parcels in and of themselves. So there's not a real big benefit to the county to sell those. It's not going to be a real big revenue generator. And there really aren't a lot of large parcels out there like this one that we can sell or will be selling in the future because county just doesn't own a lot of properties like this. As far as the process goes, let me just touch on that one more time. There's usually a discussion with staff. If there's a question about a property, I go to Pat and say, hey, Pat, what about this property? Or some of them Pat actually identified and brought to my attention. And so we discuss that, discuss pros and cons. If there's a decision to maybe surplus a property, it's, again, distributed to other departments. Make sure Parks doesn't want to retain that property or Public Works doesn't have a need for that property. After that, it might be brought to the board informally and say, what do you think about this? Or like this one, it was discussed during board time, which is their Wednesday afternoon meetings. And at some point, staff produces a report after they go through this process, and that's brought to the board on their consent agenda, on their Tuesday public hearings. Everybody can comment on those and let the counselors know what they think about surplusing those properties, whether there's pros or cons to it. But by the time it gets to them, it's been pretty well thought out and decided what are the pros and cons. At that point, the property is declared surplus, and again, that just gives county staff permission to pursue selling the property. Then they go to the process of preparing the property, getting an appraisal, assigning it to typically a company that auctions our properties off for us. That might get sold at the first auction, it might not. We have a property that's gone to the auction 3 times because the county wanted to make sure that they were getting the right dollar amount for it. So they tried remarketing it just to make sure it was getting enough exposure. So they try their best to get the best bang for the buck for the properties, but you're kind of limited to an auction environment so that everybody has an equal opportunity to bid on that property.
There's law though that states they can't sell for lower than like 10% of the appraised value or something like that, right?
Yeah, there are some guidelines that say you have to sell it for what it's reasonably worth, but if you put it in an auction and you've got a bid on it 2 times and it's less than what you originally thought it was, then you can pretty safely say, well, the actual market value is less than
Correct. Maybe
what we thought Correct. It was.
But what is the assessed value for that property?
The assessed value for this property, I think the tax assessed value, I want to say it was $600,000.
Yeah.
The county originally purchased the property for $395,000.
Tax assessed value, though, is not.
It's not market value, but it can give you a ballpark.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It should be close, though.
We like it to be close.
Except for me, my taxes are higher than what my house is listed for.
I have to conceal it, I guess. I know we're all excited here. I had several queries recently about a property that was sold, I think, in this last year, where the tax appraised value out on GIS was shown at $63,000, I believe it was. And it said it went up for auction for $10,000. Do you know anything about that issue?
I don't know about the specifics of that, but there was a parcel that we sold that was 1 acre that was kind of landlocked, not buildable, that we sold for, I think, $10,000. In that case, we got the two neighbors to bid on it or something like that. Uh-huh. But there are some parcels that we've sold in the past or maybe the treasurer has at the auction where the assessed value of it was like it was a buildable parcel, and perhaps after they sold it, they came in and said, can you do a legal lot determination and tell if it's a buildable lot? And if they determined at that point that it wasn't, then that drastically alters the value of the parcel, and it might have gone down because of that. That's a situation where I can see that happening. So, if you had a 5-acre parcel that's buildable, it's worth $100,000 maybe more. If it's not buildable and you got a 5-acre piece you can grow trees on, it's maybe worth 30, so because you can't use it for residence. So something similar to that might have happened, but I could look into a particular instance.
I've had I think 3 different people bring that to my attention. Mm-hmm. And I shared it with Bill and
mm-hmm. I'd be happy with individual.
Yeah, just didn't have a good. I did not have a good answer, but said I would ask.
Well, I think I've taken up more than my allotted 20 minutes. But if you have any additional questions, we could wrap it up. And if not, we can hand it off to Pat Lee, and he's going to explain in more detail the process for this Paradise Square Pearson property to inform you on that.
Great information. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Tough questions you always have.
Yeah, and I am in the board's office. If you have any questions ever, do please call.
We appreciate you coming and educating us.
Absolutely. Thank you. Okay. Pearson specific, not general surplus property. That's what I'm going to talk about. As Peter mentioned, this property was acquired in 1996 with a combination of County Conservation Futures funds and a state grant. One of the requirements of the state grant is that when we secure the property, we in essence give the state an interest in that property and provide them with a recorded deed of right that says we will keep this property in perpetuity for open space purposes. But there is a process where you can go through what is called a grant conversion, but it has very specific requirements on sort of a public process that you have to go through, and the state has to approve ultimately whether that property, the process stands up to the requirements for approving grant conversions. Basically, that process is the county must complete an alternatives analysis of all opportunities for avoiding conversion and for replacement properties that provide equivalent recreation value consistent with the grant category for which the state funds were awarded. This category, the Pearson property, was acquired under the water access category where the primary intent is to get people on the water. Now, the reason we have these properties, that all these properties, roughly about 250 acres almost, between Paradise Point State Park and the Center Bottoms, were secured with the same grant. About a $900,000 grant, which was matched by about $900,000 of Conservation Futures funds. And so all those properties have that conversion restriction on them. So in terms of the examination of whether we meet conversion requirements, the county has to provide evidence that the public has been given a reasonable opportunity to participate in the identification, development, and evaluation of alternatives. The minimum requirement is publication of a public notice initiating a 30-day public comment period on an alternatives analysis. And we would then follow that up as comments come in with finalizing the alternatives analysis, making changes as necessary, much like was done through the comp plan process. And then providing a final report approved by the board through to the Recreation and Conservation Office, which is the state grant funding agency through which most of the state open space and recreation grants are administered. If a conversion, one of the things that I mentioned, you have to address, okay, avoidance of the conversion. You know, if we didn't convert, we kept the home, what would we have to do? Well, the water access category and many other grant categories, not all categories, say that a structure has to be removed. They do not allow a structure to be retained on the property. So technically we're inconsistent with the grant requirement at this point. Or the state Recreation and Conservation Office would have to approve a reuse plan for that structure. And to date, we have not developed any reuse plan for that structure. That is certainly a path that could be pursued, but that's not the current direction that staff is receiving. So substitute properties can only be acquired from willing sellers for prices substantiated by the appraisals, fair market appraisals, and we have to submit notices of voluntary transactions by unjust compensation to landowners, to the state, so to make sure that we're meeting their requirements. And due diligence studies such as property boundary surveys, level one environmental assessment would have to be completed for any substitute properties that are put forward as compensation for this grant conversion. So kind of the current situation is that we have to go out
if we're going to continue with this conversion, we have to do an alternatives analysis that identifies potential replacement properties. And once those replacement properties are kind of narrowed down, we receive direction which are the highest priorities to pursue, we would have to go out and contact the landowners. We would have to do appraisals to be sure that, one, landowners are willing sellers and they get a fair market appraisal that is not meeting seller expectations, so they might initiate the discussion. But in the end, when the appraisal comes through, they decide that it's not meeting their expectations, so they don't want to go forward. And if they don't want to go forward, that's their choice. We understand that. But that is a challenge at times. And in terms of the alternatives analysis, I've developed a working draft, still undergoing internal review. Hopefully we could get that out in a couple of weeks for public comment. We will certainly notify the Parks Board, probably place a notice in the newspaper that we are initiating this public comment period on this alternatives analysis. We'll go to the State Recreation and Conservation Office in November just for an introduction, much like the introduction you're getting today with a working draft. And it probably would not be until February's meeting of the Recreation and Conservation Office that they could actually take an action to approve a conversion, if that's the direction the board chooses to go, and to identify the replacement property that we are to pursue to meet the grant requirements. So, for those wanting to keep engaged in this process regarding the Pearson property, you should look for that alternatives analysis. Offer your comments. Certainly, if the Parks Board as a whole wants to comment on it, you're welcome to do so. Neighborhood associations as well. So, that is the overall process. What I can tell you in terms of the initial alternatives analysis that I've been doing, I started looking in terms of screening. I looked at all riverfront parcels between Paradise Point State Park and Louisville Park. So you're talking a pretty long way. We are looking for parcels that make logical, significant trail extensions. There may not be a trail yet, there may be a trail yet, there may be a trail that could be potential in a short period of time. But we're looking for those areas where we could do a meaningful segment as opposed to a 200-foot segment of a trail in terms of evaluation. The parcels should be undeveloped, the grant requirements, water access, we should remove the structures, so buying another house, or if you're going to buy another house or another structure, doesn't have to be a house, it could be a barn. We'll have to tear that down or get an approved reuse plan from the state. Physical characteristics reasonably able to support the trail alignment. I think in response to Lori's question earlier, that's mainly a cost question. You can probably build a trail anywhere. You might have to narrow down the cross section some. You may have to do some more or less mitigation depending on the location. And obviously when we do trail alignment studies, we try to be sensitive in how we're impacting the environment, but there may be times when you have no other alternative to cross a wetland but to maybe build a boardwalk, or if you're going to cross a creek to build a bridge. So these are expensive things, and at this point we do not have a trail alignment adopted for the Lower East Fork Greenway Trail. So again, it will take some time, one, to develop an alignment, and two, to get the resources together to make that trail along the lower. And we might do it incrementally, like I said, extend the trail at Ellis Center Bottoms, a few more parcels, if those are choices for replacement parcels. Try and get between Daybreak Park and what we call our Lewis Lipper Ranch property, which is that strip of land that we own between Louisville Park and Daybreak Park along the river. Those are kind of the prioritization that I'm hoping will come forward as this alternatives analysis is reviewed by the public. You know, we think that these are the most important priorities. The board agrees and directs us to contact those landowners to see if they're willing sellers to get the appraisal started, et cetera. Then, in all likelihood, I believe the Recreation and Conservation Office will approve of the conversion, but they do have to approve.
So they, I'll go ahead.
You go ahead.
So you have to have the replacement property there and ready to go as part of the package, not necessarily purchased, but identified. And
that is the most secure path, conceivably. And I did check this out with the Recreation and Conservation Office. You go ahead and just buy a parcel. Go through the process and hope for the best outcome. I don't really think that's the wisest course of action.
Right.
Especially because you don't know, you may have a clear number one choice, but you know, if there's a willing seller there.
Right. And does it need to be in the same region or sub-region or something? Extend?
The direction we've received from the board is to try and look within this area that
makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
I believe that would be the preference of the Recreation and Conservation Office as well. I don't think it's an absolute requirement, but to me it seems the most logical course of action.
It's beyond the 5th district, so.
So can we use the funds from the sale of Paradise to level any, whether it's a home or a structure or a barn or something that might be on a piece of property? Can we utilize
I have not asked that specific question as yet. My gut feel is that may be possible because the revenues from the sale of the surplus property are supposed to go into the purchase of the replacement. Rather than the sale of the surplus property, if they own a replacement property. And it has to be of equal market value based on today's prices and equivalent recreation value.
So would it be conceivable to buy something with the structure, level it, and maybe level a part of the property that could be future trail at the same time? Like, is this moving some earth around?
I think, you know, if you're going to have heavy equipment in there, you're going to need some sort of temporary access. And yes, we at times do look at those temporary construction access routes as convenient trail corridors.
This is looking really good. Like, let's find something with a old barn on it so we can level it and make a
nice trail.
Access trail as the start of our program.
When it comes to park impact fee funding, you know, with regard to acquisition, when we buy a piece of property, we can use acquisition funding to secure that property as far as removing the house, fencing it, signing it, and making sure that it is safe for public, which means pruning the trees. So that all is incorporated in with acquisition. I don't know if it is the same with conservation.
The guidelines say you basically follow the same process as an RCO acquisition, which is the process you just outlined.
All right, that ups the ante for
the
what properties
be,
you want to look at.
But the question would be on that.
It's got a
headline.
It's called
does that, you know, do you get credit for the value of the improvement on that property when you're trying to assess market value or not?
And can you say you've got a barn in good shape? Could you repurpose it to a pavilion or something?
Yes, the state could approve a reuse plan.
Yeah.
But again, the state has to lay in and approve it.
Right. Well, they always do what we want them to.
Yeah, maybe you could tell us directly, do any of your targeted replacement properties have structures on?
I've done a very coarse screening because I personally don't want to be the one that narrows it down to 3 parcels.
Don't.
That's not my role. I'm to do the staff work. The board's the one that's going to narrow it down to the replacement properties based on what they receive from the public in terms of input. What I have done to this point, again, it's still undergoing internal review. I have identified about 52 potential parcels in that stretch between Paradise Point State Park and based on that course screening that I said. And, you know, really looking for the public process to help
prioritize what makes the most sense.
Are you structured at your department level to be able to identify the total cost of this entire initiative by any chance?
Pardon me?
Are you structured to be able to identify the total cost of this specific initiative in staff time and...
Well, that is exactly what we did when we went to the board hearing. I presented fiscal impact statement and said, it's going to cost X amount of staff time, it's going to cost X amount of outside consultant services. The board said, initiate the process.
It's not uncommon to surplus a piece of property that, I mean, it's just, it pricks people's interest that maybe it's not a good idea for, you know, but, or maybe it is a good idea, but school districts do it, and really it's for good intent from everything I've seen.
Yeah, if you can put it to better use.
But, you, yeah, it's kind of an interesting situation because if you have a whole bunch of homes, right, a whole bunch of properties along the river, and we're basically, we're talking about generally, you know, water access probably the whole way, right, between Paradise Point and Louisville Park. We're thinking...
My starting point was riverfront parcels, although where we just own a narrow strip of land, which we do in some spots, I did identify the next layer of parcels out there that might be considered in my very coarse analysis here.
You know, that's a difficult, you know, it's kind of like very similar to the rails to trails, or the, you know, people are like, I don't know if I really want public access right next to my home on the water, you know, so there's, you know, people walking by, in, you know, in front of their beautiful view of the river, so it just makes it...
Well, the one thing we contend with, I got a question for Pat also, but the one thing we contend with is, you know, we want to buy a narrow strip of property, you know, say along a river corridor, and the folks don't want to sell that narrow strip just for that same purpose, but they're willing to sell us the whole 40 acres that they live on. Well, of course, that prices us out of the market immediately.
Right.
And so the question, Pat, is if we can't necessarily buy a piece of property, are we able to buy a non-exclusive easement?
Mm-hmm. My direction from RCO is no. We purchased this Pearson property in fee. They're looking for in fee replacement. Certainly, we do have conservation easements along the lower East Fork in spots, a couple of spots. But in terms of the grant conversion process, they have said they're looking for a fee acquisition if the decision is to go for a replacement property. Now, that said, you could boundary line adjust some parcels through the process so you have a 50-acre parcel that really only has a small gap right along the river, depending on the zoning and the lot configuration, would be possible to cleave off 10 or 20 acres of the 50-acre parcel as a replacement parcel. You'd still acquire that in fee, but you'd have to do that boundary line adjustment process as a preliminary step to the acquisition. But that is a possibility, and I think, you know, at least some of my initial parcels that I've identified, that might make sense. But again, we don't have the appraisal yet of what the market value of Pearson is. We're expecting that in a couple of weeks. So gauging a comparable valuation is challenging at this point, notwithstanding my reliance on the assessor's information at this point.
Which is fantastic.
I can love my job.
Any other questions?
Of course, it's fine. How often have you been through this process before?
Only indirectly. I was tangentially involved in the Foley Park conversion, which was a very arduous process. When I presented my cost information to the board about what this would cost, I was kind of looking at that one, and, you know, someone had the foresight to identify what that costs.
that was a federal grant that supported the Salmon Creek Greenway development, which was what was being converted in that case. So it was a more complicated process where you had to do a federal environmental assessment, but it's not an inexpensive process to do this.
And what do you feel like the chances are of getting to the end after spending all of this time and resources that the RCO would shut it down and say no?
I believe if we have a defensible alternatives analysis and public process that leads to decision and we identify a replacement property that they can see, at least, you know, in their estimation is equivalent recreational value and market values, it has to be. I believe they'll approve it. That doesn't mean I'm right, but I believe that's what will happen.
I had a discussion with RCO, Laura Moxon, about land conversion and so on. I thought we were doing a park tour. And she basically told me, of course, they make it very arduous for a purpose. They don't want you doing it in the first place. However, if the respective government agency who is going through this process has all the ducks in a row, they said, we really cannot say no to that process. We will pretty much have to agree to it. But it's not an easy process, like Pat says, and for a reason. And so they want to discourage that from happening.
So really, the potential sale of this one property would probably only get you maybe a sliver of one or two pieces of land. Who knows, right?
Because it would depend on the market valuation of the property and the market valuation of any replacement property. I think in reference to one of the questions earlier about can you get a trail here because it's a lot of wetland. Certainly, if you're going to have a large parcel that is largely in a floodplain, it's going to be a little lesser value, presumably, than what an upland parcel would be. So I believe a very plausible situation would be that we, if we were to sell a property, we'd sell 20 acres or 5 acres, whatever. You know, the house is just on 5 acres. There's actually a second parcel around it there, like they're budding. So it looks like one parcel, but there are two parcels. But I suspect probably sell better as one complete parcel.
Based on zoning, it's Ag 20, so we can't really create a small 5 acre.
Well, you'd have to go through the legal lots determination process, and both of those are legal lots of record. I don't know if they are or not. That's something I don't want to get into just yet. Well, it's got
implications.
Well, and we have to pay a fee to do the legal lot of determination, so I'm trying to be conservative in my use of funds to the extent I can. I think it's possible that you could sell a 20 acres and a replacement property might be 40 acres.
Oh, okay. Well,
again, it just depends the property.
Right.
So Pat, let's say you do find, say, three or four properties that equal the 20 acres that are being sold. Would that be allowable? Let's say you find four segments that you want to buy and the aggregate total is 20 or more acres.
Yes.
So we can.
Do you have to purchase the property first and then sell the surplus, or which?
Well, presumably the revenues, I would imagine you probably coordinate the escrow dates so that you would be able to receive the revenues from the sale of property and apply that towards the purchase of the new property. I mean, someone said that we have all the money in the world. We don't have all the money in the world in conservation futures. We have significant debt service that we have to pay each year from prior revenue bonds. I don't think that's the actual technical term, but from bonding, where we're using conservation futures revenues that come in, which is, it's a property tax levy, it comes in every year, And, you know, you're paying debt, fairly significant amount of debt each year. So we try to keep a healthy fund balance so that when an opportunity comes by, I mean, the most recent property we bought cost $2.13 million. So it's, you know, we're looking for, generally for fairly substantial pieces with some significant environmental and recreational attributes. And it's even better if they're, well, if they're large, like 150 acres, they're kind of big enough to freestand. But if you have several that might be of a smaller scale and you can expand the greenway out from some of the existing holdings, I think those are things that we look at as good attributes when we are trying to prioritize acquisition opportunities.
I think you referenced it earlier, the conservation areas acquisition plan kind of lays out how they prioritize parcels in and where they are. There's some good details in there if you want to look that up on your own.
Well, this has been very enlightening, and I want to say that I really appreciate not only the big picture overview that you brought for us, but being willing to get down to the particulars where we've been receiving a lot of questions. And need to have some answers to give. And I think we're more equipped at this point to do that for residents. So thanks so much.
Absolutely. Yeah. Very good.
Well, and do feel free to give my name and have people call the board's office and say, hey, ask Pete the question, and I'll try to get them the answer.
And we got your number. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
So moving right along, it looks like we've got homework for next month, Bill. You want to tell us about
it? Could we do that after about a 5-minute break?
Take a 5-minute break. Sounds good to me. $257.
So do I write that down?
Are we ready?
Yeah.
Is that part?
Is that part? You can. Five minute break if you want.
Yes, Candace had to leave. Yes.
Said Chris at some point.
Yes.
I will make sure that I get the homework out to everybody, though.
Yes.
That's where I want to get into this and define expectation and action, so I can make sure everybody is on task to do that.
That sounds good. So I'm going to stand up here. I've been sitting quite a while here.
Yeah.
But, on this cover sheet here, it shows all of the 9 different projects that we have identified that
this
I brought
one?
Up. Yes, the cover sheet here.
Okay.
I brought this up at our last meeting, our Parks and Recreation Board meeting, kind of identified them individually. And I want to take a moment just to kind of go into them just a little bit deeper because we have an expectation here that we have a timeline to meet the here and after. Now that the Parks comp plan is completed, we need to start moving forward. With the grants being due on March 1st, we need to start looking, or actually actively working on the grants that we collectively choose.
So, but the GMA doesn't get approved from the county until June. But because this has been approved already, then that is just going to be approved as a part of theirs,
yes.
So we're good.
That's
yeah,
correct.
We're good.
And the comp plan has been approved by resolution by the Board of County Councilors.
Yeah.
That makes us eligible to move forward with
yes.
grants in the eyes
of our
RCO.
Yeah, that was one of our big drivers.
Okay.
Gotcha.
So with these 9 projects that we have, you can see there's a combination of acquisition in urban and development in urban, as well as regional in acquisition and development in the regional side. And so some of these projects, of course, are a much higher dollar level than other ones. Some of these do have some time factors affiliated with them. And I'll go through these one by one. Actually, the rest of these slides are breaking them down individually. So if we go to the next page. So this is the number 1 acquisition, and that it says acreage west of I-5. That is impact fee number 10, which is one we're closest to in concurrency, which means we need to buy a piece of property on one of these potential sightings here within District 10 by April of 2016, or we will be in concurrency, which means we have to give the money back in District 10 back to all the homeowners in that particular area with penalty.
That's a huge
It'll take staff about 6 to 8 months to make that happen.
That's the one I've been kicking around about for forever. Find me some property.
So one thing that Jeremy and I are working on right now is we are securing a contract with an agency that is going to actively go out and look for these properties. All these districts will be in the multiple listing service, and so we'll have hopefully a myriad of different agents looking for properties that suit our needs. We've given the criteria 3 to 5 acres, actually even 2 to 5 acres. We're not being too picky, but we want to find a piece of property somewhere, preferably west side of I-5, as identified here.
Yeah. And if I might just add to that, just knowing this neighborhood intimately, and this is where my sadness comes in, is that logically, probably the place we'll actually be able to secure some land at this point is going to be north of Fairgrounds Park. I mean, that's where the open area is going to be. Where you really need it, you desperately have needed it, is that concentration of all the development that went on along 149th there. Those kids, for them to cross over to get to the Chinook part, for example. Right. And that's where I said, okay, alternative, let's get a sidewalk in there. Let's get crossings that are safe for the kids to get across to there. But to be honest, a lot of the parents there just won't let their children go to Chinook Park because they got to cross that. That's a busy street now.
Oh, it's huge, yes.
And, you know, so our real need, if we could find a priority, it would be, because there's still time that hasn't developed out there. It's still a lot of agricultural, you know, in the northern area of PIF District 10. Where you've got a huge, strong concentration. They have 2 school buses that go just through my housing development.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Huge concentration of people in that area.
So there's a lot of children with a lot of need there.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know. Yeah, we have a density requirement, correct? Or a density that we try to shoot per 1,000 homes.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
Yes.
But
neighborhood parks at 2,000.
Right now, this is just your PIF district. Sorry, didn't mean to sidetrack you.
And so I can either talk about the pros and cons after the fact, or I can talk about them right now. The one thing that RCO does require is that we keep them in the loop from the very get-go, whether it's acquisition or development. And so if we do come across a piece of property that we are very interested in, and we have probably made a purchase agreement or are, you know, entering a purchase agreement with the respective owner, at that particular time is when we need to get RCO invested. And we need to get their input. And I heard the turnaround time is not too long. And I asked that question of concern because RCO is not real great about getting back to us in a timely manner. And I don't want to see a sale fall through waiting for them to give us their blessing.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. And so with all these projects, whether it's acquisition or development, we need to make sure that they are clued in from the very beginning at the conceptual phase.
Bill, what are we looking at here with the stars? What's the star representing?
What you're seeing here are these gray areas. This is what Gene created. Uh-huh. See what you plot this out. These are existing neighborhood parks right here.
Yeah.
This is a community park in the valley. This grid right here is half a mile walking distance. It has some crow flies. It's how you walk to that site.
Okay.
So it's kind of more of a grid type pattern here.
Okay.
So if you're walking to any one of the parks, our plan is to be able to walk to, this is for everybody in Clark County, in the urban area, to have a park with a 1/2 mile walking distance.
Right.
That's what this indicates. So basically from here to here to here is half a mile distance from here. So here's half mile.
Okay. Now I'm following it all.
This is a potential siting for a community park. Right.
Gotcha.
Here. Okay. This is a fairground park existing.
So the blue stars are the service gaps.
Yes, exactly. These blue stars are potential sitings for property acquisition because they are service gaps. So these could, some place, you know, in the utopian future, all these stars
very
could be
cool.
Filled with parks. Okay.
Cool, Matt. I wasn't exactly sure what I was looking at, but now I get it. Thank you.
Okay, that's number one. That's acquisition. Just so you know, just from experience and talking to a lot of folks, acquisition is much easier than development when it comes to RCO grants because it's pretty clear cut. You know, you have a purchase price, you go after RCO for 50% match, done deal. When it comes to development grants, you have to be very specific as to what you're using that money for because there's a lot of things that do not qualify. And so you can actually leave a lot of grant money on the table because they come back and tell you that, I'm sorry, this doesn't qualify, this doesn't qualify, this doesn't qualify. That happened to us at the Slash Trail project. And I've heard lots of woes on the
Okay, so let's move on to the next one, Tower Crest. This is a park that has already been designed. And with a lot with the board giving us on one of our decision packages is to help support the maintenance of these parks by moving some general fund parks back to general fund that are currently in MPD. If that does happen, that will free up the money that we need to maintain these parks. So this is Tower Crest. Ready to design. If we do get the funding to maintain this will start construction in May. The problem with this site, the downside, is that we did not include RCO at the beginning of this project. The one thing we can do is clue them in as to when we might start construction. So the construction component will qualify for RCO grant funding, but the whole planning piece does not. So that's a strong consideration that we have to keep in mind for narrowing these 9 projects down to 3.
Where at on the map does, I know you gave me some cross-reference, but I'm having trouble identifying.
It's not on the map. This is in District 7.
Okay, it's in District 7.
Completely different area. It's behind Vancouver Board. Tower Crest is it's west of Andreessen, south of 54th Street. Okay.
I'm just trying to put in my brain where in the community that
geographically,
is.
I can show you probably.
So that's our 500 to call that to Andreessen and north, and it's west of Andreessen.
And okay. South of what? Of 50.
So this is like the Walnut Grove. I'm thinking in terms of my school district. So this is like near the Walnut Grove area.
Yes, it is.
Nice.
It's
okay.
Isn't it southeast of Walnut Grove?
Okay.
Isn't that area up for being incorporated into the city?
City.
At some point, though.
Isn't this over in Linda and Sue's area?
Yeah, it's north of Vancouver Ford and west of Andreessen. So before you get to Minnehaha, it's going to be between that area. It's in that general populace.
Yeah, it is over in their area.
Yeah. You'll see a huge water tower right here. Someplace. Right here. There's a huge water tower. If you get anywhere close, you'll start seeing this water tower. It's about 100 feet tall, can't miss it. So it's part of that property. This is a county-owned property right here. This is all city-owned right here. This is going to remain in that open space. So the city has no intention of doing anything with this property around it. So that's actually a complement to this park property. Mm-hmm. That's going to stay natural and trees. And then of course you have the what's that grower? That's over here.
Coons Farms.
Coons Farms is right here. So that the downside is that we would not receive all the funding that we would want because the whole planning piece has already been completed. So let's move on to the next one. This is Sorensen Park, same thing. We're in the planning process right now, our design process, and that should be completed before May. And if we get the maintenance funding we need, this park will start construction in May to be finished somewhere around October 15th. And so, $810,000 total cost of the park. We've already expended some monies in the design aspect of this. We're looking at half of that, $405,000 in grant funds. Will we get that? Probably not, because we've already expended some monies. I don't know if this is a really good candidate, if you will, for grant funding. This one more Tower Crest. So, I just wanted to make sure that I identified all 9 projects that we have slated for 2016.
Now, the reason you say it's not a good candidate for grant funding is because you're so far along in the planning process?
Exactly.
Okay.
I mean, I think it's better to identify a project at the very beginning
sure.
to get their buy-in so we have maximum grant eligibility. Sure.
So, Bill, okay. At our GMA discussion, there were a couple neighbors who spoke up that they believed that the planning for this park and such was far enough removed from today's date that they didn't have a voice or a say in the plan. Is there any intention to go back and do some neighborhood discussions?
We had an open house not too long ago.
I know, yeah. I know you had all of it. So I didn't know if, based on some of that, if it caused any problems or if we're just moving forward.
It came up. I think that pacified a lot of folks by having that open house. They weren't really asked to take a look at the entire design of the property. It was more so just to play equipment. We had a good turnout. What we had, Jeff, about 45 people.
That showed up.
And I would like more to add to that.
I thought there was actually a really good turnout given, you know, our open houses for the comp plan.
Neighborhood objected to. So.
And the folks who were allowed to choose, they put a dot. They had four choices of different playground scapes to choose from, and they were allowed to put a dot on their favorite one.
And then you also made those changes on the pathway that affected the total cost, which brought it more into alignment.
Yeah, there's a discussion right here. There's a lot of conversation about this pathway, this ADA accessible pathway that is going up to the very top of the hill, which is a huge expense. We thought about maybe bringing it up a part of the way. I don't know what the final determination was on that, but if we do come up with these cost considerations, that's probably going to be the one thing that does get cut. So,
yeah.
This is basically the sledding hill that comes down. This is necessarily at the ADA to the top, so it unnecessarily has to be sled down from anywhere here.
Isn't that funny to think that it can be covered with snow and we're still going to provide wheelchair access? Like, you can't put your wheelchair in
Well, I went there, and like I told her, those of us that have got any type of disability are not going to make, because it is pretty steep.
It is.
Hey, just a correction. It's not just snow. We took cardboard, and you can slide down that on cardboard.
It's deep enough where you can slide on a wet surface, yes.
And I think we already have an easement in place for the pathway in.
I'm sorry, say that one.
We already have an easement in place for the pathway.
Yes, right here. So thank you to the school district.
We did that years ago when we first wanted to do it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. That was a huge concern.
That was a big thing.
Making sure that this park is accessible from
the
east side.
That's because the school was so close.
They have to walk all the way around to get into the park.
That's a win-win.
That's okay. If we were separated from the city and the county at the time, it would have been an easier discussion with the county.
Yes.
The city was making us mad.
If we create a trail system from Louisville Park to Paradise Point, would that go under your umbrella?
Yes. Okay. It would essentially be part of our park's responsibility.
Okay.
Yes. That's the whole idea between Conservation Futures. They acquire the property, and at some point in time, with the intent of making it an actual park property. Unless it was bought strictly for conservation purposes. In which case, we can still put we can still have passive recreation, like a chip trail going through it. So there's always a possibility to put a trail system through. Well, it's like we said, or like Pat said, we put a trail just about anywhere. It's about cost. Okay. I got a cool little system.
This is exciting.
Kaleida Community Park parking lot.
Super cool.
Okay, next one, Jeremy. Okay, this is Kaleida Community Park. This is a piece of property that we've already acquired. It's the neighbor off to the west.
Yep.
And it's gonna open the view into this park, plus give us all the additional parking that we need to support all the sports programming that's going on here, as well as the big parks functions like what Milana has. She has a big 4th of July celebration. And right now, this street has been built out, and there's really no parking on the street anymore, so it's becoming actually a hazard, because fire trucks can't get through there when the cars are parked on both sides. So we bought this piece of property. What we might ask for grant funding for is the development of that parking lot. It is, what's the size of that property? It's 0.65 acres, something like that. It's over half an acre in size. It should accommodate about 75 to 80 cars. We bought this up in Havlick last year, I think.
Yeah, good.
Anyways, we've identified the cost to actually build this out with asphalt and make an ADA accessible parking lot with access into the park. It was total cost $285,000. And so wanting to match that with would be $142,500. So in the grand scheme of things, if we are looking at going after grants, I don't know if this would really be a hot one for us to take a look at, because the money value is pretty low. I'd rather kind of shoot for a higher number.
The 500K one.
How about we ask the Kaleida neighborhood to come up with some match?
Yes, we can do that. We can use partnerships to help
and
us out.
They're pretty excited about that stuff. We're the soccer associations that utilize that. They have nowhere to park. There may be some opportunity to leverage.
And that's all part of where we're going this year.
Yeah.
Even the
transportation or the fire department or something, right? Because if they can't get their car through, I imagine once we develop that parking lot, they'll make it no parking. I mean, that's kind of a given, right? Because you're not going to both create and keep your same problem. So maybe there's some transportation concept there where you can do that.
Right. So that might be the plan going forward is using private partnerships, you know, that's sports cool. leagues and associations to help us with that.
Yeah.
Again, we put all 9 projects that we plan to move forward on in 2016. So we need to choose probably the top 3 going forward. Okay, Jerry. Okay.
So I'm just going to make a little statement here. It's at 3:15, and you've got a lot to cover. So I'm going to ask that everybody hold conversation till next meeting on all of these.
Absolutely.
So that you can cover it all.
Yes.
Is that okay?
Yes.
Thanks.
I think our intent is to probably study these during the course of this month and hopefully vote on it in the November meeting. And we probably will have a few email correspondence going back and forth, questions and answers.
Okay.
I'll try to inform you as well as I can going forward.
Great.
Okay, so these projects, these are followed by some pictures here, shortcomings. So East Fork Coast Greenway, Conservation Futures, $2.1 million, 150 acres to close gaps to expand the greenway. This is largely what Pat and Peter were talking about. We're trying to close those gaps to create that trail system along that greenway. And so, of course, we're going to invest some money into that. And so in doing that, it sounds like if all goes well with this grant conversion, we'll actually have some more money to put towards that. But we'll be asking for $1 million in grant funds. Lower Daybreak Park, that is the acquisition development phase 1 improvements. That, we'll show you a picture of that in a second. And Slash Prairie Railroad Trail, $2.6 million, $1.3 in grant funds. That is the acquisition component to purchase the additional right-of-way we need to build that trail out. Let's move on to the pictures here to talk about those. Here's the next one. Okay, so let's go to the next slide. Well, I can go back to this last one. Here's the entire Slash of Greenland Trail. It goes from Vancouver Lake all the way out to Slash of Prairie. And so it shows all right here. The areas that we're focusing on is right here in the Battleground Corridor. So let's go to the next one. Let's go to the next one, yeah. Okay, so we have 2 trail segments that we're identifying. Here is Battleground Fairgrounds, right here. And here is Battleground Lake State Park, right here. The idea is to create a trail that connects these two destinations. Right now, we have a trail that has been built almost halfway back. Stops right here at the DNR property, essentially. What we want to do is connect that, or build this remaining lane, so we have 2 true destinations. Right now, we have this really beautiful asphalt trail along the railroad corridor that stops, goes to nowhere. Mm-hmm. And we have 3 parking lots that we have to pay for to the state each year to the tune of $1,800 to allow for public parking without having to buy the pass. And so once this trail is connected, then of course this is probably going to be one of our most highest used trails, just like our Sandy Creek Trail. Probably have over 1 million people using it per year. Since you have a destination on both sides, it just screams building. The second phase of the trail is down here. There's some cedars out here. It's right here. Cedars Drive. Cedars Golf Course is right here. Mm-hmm. And this is the Morgan Salmon property, 80 acres that the county owns. It's a beautiful piece of property that we've got. Really well forested, and it's another destination between these 2 sites and Battleground. So the trail down here, it's about 2.5 miles in distance. And so those are those 2 separate projects that we've identified in the 2016 plan.
Cool.
And in fact, I've got a meeting with Scott Sawyer, who's the Director of Public Works, on Tuesday of next week to talk about this. So we have partners going in with us. The City of Battleground is very anxious to at least get this trail connection built, and they are very familiar with this trail connection.
And that just continues to follow the train tracks?
Yes. Go back to one slide here. Okay, so this is actually the preferred route of the trail, which leads to train tracks, this corridor. But unfortunately, this is where Cedars Golf Course is at. This is where Morgan Creek property is. Salmon Morgan, and I was talking to Scott Sawyer about this, and I said, I would much rather follow the train tracks so that this trail has a destination rather than bypassing all of that. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Isn't this the one that Milky's all up in arms over that?
He does not like the idea of the Slasher Trail.
Yeah.
That's our opposition there.
Yeah. Sorry, I wasn't supposed to.
It's okay.
So this will be something that we'll probably take apart after the first year, but if we identify it, then we'll have it earmarked that it's something that we want to go forward with. I think the other downside on this particular one is that half of that is more than what the total maximum match can be for acquisition. That is, when it comes to RCO, acquisition, the maximum amount is $1 million. For development, the maximum amount is $500,000. So we have to kind of keep that in mind. If there's anything that they can't give us a full match on, we have to come up with that extra amount. Okay, Jerry, let's move on. So this is the lower Daybreak, which is also Daybreak Park, if you will. This is a master plan, which has already been completed for Daybreak Park. This is the current Daybreak Park. You know, we get the little boat launch on the side of the road, and you got the little park piece right here. Well, here's the master plan for the rest of the big park. This is a potential horse riding arena, which will be funded by a private sector. I've actually talked to three different groups so far about this. But this is going to be the new central point of the park. Entrance comes in here. You got walking trails, you got disc golf, you got equestrian areas. There's a lot of features within this park. Pat Lee is very, very amped up to get started on the grant for this. So he's been after this since 2015. And he wants to do a joint effort on this one. So this would essentially be our next regional park.
Oh, you have a fee booth on here. You better hide that.
That's going away for right now. Erase that off.
Yeah, get that eraser out in order to get
At the time that this master plan was developed, we have the fees.
Call it a security checkpoint.
What's that?
You can call it a security checkpoint.
There you go.
The ambassador booth.
So we have a caretaker booth here.
There you go.
And just a whole area of walking trails, and this will definitely connect in with the entire lower greenway system that takes you all the way up to Paradise Point State Park.
Oh, that's so cool.
And then up to Louisville, going the other direction. Wow. So this is like a huge, you know, central destination in the moment of the trail.
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Okay, next one. Considerations and concerns. I kind of talked about that already, kind of going through as we went through it. So Sorensen Tower Crest. Well, I told you about RCO. They like to be in the know from the very beginning. When we start a project, they want to know about it, have their stamp of approval on it before we begin. Otherwise, we might not be eligible for funding.
Did I miss something? I thought it was a top 9. I only see 6.
On the front page? I think I went through them all, I hope.
We skipped through the regional development.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And I couldn't count.
I think we talked about them all.
Okay.
Yeah, we touched on
them.
Okay.
So sorry.
This is just some of the concerns. There are some other concerns, like Milky does not like selection trailers. And that's okay. You know, that's fine. It shouldn't slow us down. We should definitely keep that in our consideration. And so we just have to even keep in mind that, we need to reach out, try to get partners. Any way we can get money to afford these projects, we need to do that. We are only going to be going through, going forward with about 3. I would probably strongly suggest that we number them from 1 to 9 or something like that, you know, and then we'll collectively figure out what the top 3 or 4 should be, you know, and depending on what those are, that we can go after grants for them. So I've learned from what I've heard that we don't want to be too greedy, because then they kind of look at us like pigs, and they don't shine on us. So, of course, each and every one of these projects will have to go in front of the board and get a resolution stating that they will support these projects. So, without the resolution, no grant.
And when would they be going in front of the board for the resolution?
When it comes time to when we
to submit. So, if in other words, after the election.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
We'll identify our grants. We'll figure out which ones are going forward. Then we'll start working on a resolution. And going with that. So, because that is one of the very first requirements that RCO wants from us. Okay, so for the November meeting, prioritization of the top 3, we can probably even say 4, just so we have some latitude there. And we'll probably be requesting a vote from this board, just of support for those at the November meeting, and then from there the staff can take over and start working our magic on the grants. So
great.
That's the idea.
Cool.
Okay.
Great. Fantastic.
Who's up for
half of us?
Okay.
Is it really?
Yeah, well, in most of our leaders, we've got
Barbara
and Kelly and...
So vacancies are the next thing, Bill.
Yes, of course, this is coming up, and Jeff worked on a press release, or news release, and of course, we have to start thinking as a board of, do you want to remain on this board? There's three people, I believe, whose terms are expired, and that is Barbara, Kelly, and Marcia.
I think it's Marcia.
Is it Marcia?
I think it's Marcia. There's four.
Oh, is it four?
There's four. And I'm sorry. Oh, Greg also.
Who?
Greg.
Is that Greg
Cosman?
Greg.
Is it on screen?
I gave you the number.
Yeah, I saw it somewhere.
Yeah. On it. You all were part of the board before, so that's why. Kelly, Barbara, Greg.
And Greg. Oh, Greg Foster.
Yeah.
And so it's up to those folks to let us know, I guess, if they want to continue to be on the board. They will probably still have to resubmit their resumes and schedule appointments, which we can help with, to meet with the counselors and go through that process once again.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but do the counselors appoint, or is it Mark McCauley?
That's what I was saying. Ooh, that's a good question.
Oh, good question, yeah.
I think the counselors still have authority over boards, if I'm not mistaken. Don't
it,
they?
It depends.
No?
Yes.
It depends. It Planning depends. Commission, okay. The counselors appoint, but the Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Committee, for example, at Mark McCauley.
Okay, okay.
So what determines the difference?
I think if they're required or not.
All right.
So I think the question's going to be, is this a required board or not?
It is.
Is it? Okay.
Yes.
Then probably the counselors.
Okay.
And maybe that's a question for Amanda or something. All right. Something to think about.
We'll look into that and find out who does the candidates will report to for the interviews.
The deadline potentially is November 13th, right?
What's that?
The deadline for applications.
Yes, yes. So the 13th is when we'll need those applications in, and I'm sorry, I'm kind of falling apart here. Cold is getting the best of me.
So we're shooting for, that would be the next PAB meeting date, actually, would be the deadline for the applications and the resumes and everything.
And this will go out on your webpage as applications being accepted?
This news release will go out Monday, this coming Monday. And then, sorry, I'm just taking over.
Oh, that's fine. Go ahead.
He doesn't have a voice. Go ahead.
I feel bad. And we're hoping, obviously, we're waiting on the board to let us know if there's actually going to be room to squeeze this in before the end of the year, because obviously December is pretty tough with holidays and everything. So we're waiting to hear on that.
Working with Rebecca, is that right?
Jennifer.
Oh, Jennifer.
Was going to look into it, and I think let me or Karen know.
Yeah, okay. We're trying to pencil some time in with the board so that we make sure that they do their due diligence. And so it's either them or Mark. This is a required board, so it might be the counselors. So.
Yeah, could be.
Okay. Good question to ask them.
So just stating that, we'd love to have our current staff, if at all possible, our current our board members, and you guys have done a wonderful job.
Yeah. I'd like to reiterate that for certain people that need to stick around and continue providing the leadership.
Barbara, correct.
And Kelly.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for the confidence.
Yep.
Okay. Any questions?
You guys are amazing. So, you guys are amazing. So
I think the one thing we'll probably do is send some emails out to initiate to see who is interested in moving forward.
I really think it's just up to them to apply at this point.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think that you really need to let us know. That's the feeling I got, is that really, I mean, obviously you can let us let Bill know.
Well, I'll make some calls and do a temperature check with Marcia and Greg. Kelly and I have already chatted a bit.
Okay, all right, that would be great.
Yeah, I think the process.
I think with it only being in a month, that they need to be made aware of it, especially since they weren't here today.
Yes.
Yes, exactly. Thank you, Barbara.
However, there is a requirement to show up for these meetings, right? I mean, so we need to reinforce that with those who aren't showing. They may offer a great perspective to our group, but they're not going to Skype in, or they're not going to be a part of this in even offline email discussions, and they're holding a seat that needs to be utilized by someone who's helpful.
That's great. Yeah. I believe in our in the bylaws it states that if a member misses more than two meetings out of a year's time, then it's up to the board to replace them if they so wish. So.
Good
it's a commitment.
I'm sure
it is. We dearly appreciate it.
Well, no offense, but you know.
Yeah, we're coming to the end of the 10 year there.
Yeah,
so.
Help out the rest of us.
Yeah. So super.
Okay.
So once this goes out, do you want me to email it to Kelly and Greg since they weren't here today? Or are you
that would be great. I always say it never hurts to hear the same message three or four times.
Okay.
You want me to
now you mentioned your meeting. I'm trying to think of your voice here. If anything, you know, I think you mentioned your meeting with the...
I did. I mentioned that I'm meeting with Scott Sawyer with the City of Battleground this next week, and Jeremy and I are. And we're also meeting with, Tim Schell. He is the Public Works Director with Richfield. He has already initiated a plan to start building a mega sports complex at the Richfield intersection corridor. And they, of course, need some financial help with that. And so we are meeting on Monday to talk about what we can possibly do. Of course, my answer to that is I won't know until December. You know,
is this out near Abrams Park where they have this sports field now?
I don't know if that's what the meeting is about, to specifically take a look. And I plan to give you our Parks Advisory Board a full report on it after our meeting.
What's a mega sports complex?
It is bigger than this by far. It's probably twice the size of this. It's got camping facilities. It's got it's a destination. So
it's
people will come in from different states for big competitions. It's what our stakeholders brought up to us during our stakeholder sessions, that we here in Clark County lack a mega sports complex. We are not very friendly because we don't allow overnight camping. This is probably one of our largest facilities here. Delta Park is, you know, larger than this. And yet we are still not meeting the expectation of our sports leagues when it comes to a true destination for sports play and tournament play. And so Richfield is taking the bull by the horns, and they are initiating that step. And so this is going to be a monster of a facility, and I'm anxious to see what the whole scope of that's going to look like, and I will share that with you as soon as I find out.
Let's add another 18 holes out there, shall we? That'll be fun. That's right, something we don't need as a county.
The other stuff is just general information. I met with Vlad Gittman with Washington Wildlife and Recreation, and they are the principal party responsible for getting all the funds to RCO to distribute out to all of us in Washington State. And they have given us millions and millions of dollars in the past through RCO. In fact, they created RCO. And so when we found that out, we paid Mr. Vlad Gittman a lot more respect. And the monies that they bring in, 100% of those monies go back out in the form of grants. And so he's asking us to support them with an annual membership of $1,500, and which we are glad to. So that supports that staff.
Great.
Okay.
I've asked Jennifer to adjourn for us because I have my grandson.
Okay.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you so much, Barbara.
Thanks, Barbara.
The just real briefly, the Land Water Conservation Fund, that is our federal funding source. And it's their 50th anniversary, and that has expired as of October 1st. And renewing that fund is in the hands of Congress right now. And it doesn't, just from the rhetoric and articles I've seen, it's being discussed at length, and there's a lot of changes being proposed. And so we're a little nervous about that. When it comes to federal funding, I think maybe only 10% or less of all the monies that we've gotten through grants came from the federal funds. It's mostly all Washington State funding. But nonetheless, it represents billions of dollars across the United States, and so we definitely want to support that effort.
Yeah.
That's all I've got. Oh, yes, I got one more thing, sorry.
Go over that event, yeah.
Yes, potentially. I've got this as tentative. I just want to bring it to your attention. On the backside, under upcoming events, on October 29th at 2 o'clock at Orchards Park. There is intended to be a Douglas fir tree planting ceremony in honor of Dan Evans, our former governor of Washington State, and that'll be presided by Councillor Stewart and possibly other councillors as well, we're not sure. It's anticipated that Slade Gordon, another former governor, will be in attendance there. And it's supposed to be somewhat of a small ceremony, but it could escalate into a much larger ceremony, depending on how many councillors we have there. And anyway, so I just wanted to bring that to your attention in case you wanted to attend.
I would just reiterate that this is still somewhat tentative.
Yes.
The county, if this indeed is the time to date, the county will be putting out more information on it shortly.
Yes, but there should be a
news release. Any particular reason why we would want to attend?
Oh, well,
tree
I mean,
planting he, in park?
As a former governor, he was responsible for creating the Department of Ecology for Washington State, mm-hmm. and had a lot of different things that he has done in his three terms as governor, and in support of parks, a lot of those things. I'm in favor of holding a ceremony, you know, in our park, honoring him for all the accomplishments that he's done in the past. So it has gotten some traction and is going forward. And so we typically do not do this kind of thing in our parks. We usually go through the Parks Foundation, but this is a little different. So it's an honor of a governor who's done a lot for parks in his past and ecology. So.
Can I make a quick announcement?
Sure.
Saturday, October 24th, 10 o'clock, Luke Jensen right here. I think it's the City of Vancouver Parks. It's Make a Difference Day.
Oh, yes.
Volunteers to go out and come here. There's a training, and they'll send you out to the different parks to do things such as cleaning up cigarette butts or cleaning up the parks. And I'm going to be involved. And
our volunteer coordinator, Karen Llewellyn, will be definitely involved. Yes. She's very active in that. In fact, the one thing I'd like to do in the near future is have her give you a presentation, which she has not done, I don't think, since this board's been formed. We've talked about our volunteer program and all the aspects of it, but I think a presentation by her would really help you see the full picture of what we're up to with volunteers.
Has that gone out to like all of our local churches? Like a press release to them? Because those kids and those youth programs, they're always looking for like, what is that service project we're going to do today on a Saturday? And
Karen's
so,
in pretty close contact.
Okay, good.
This Saturday is the Latter-day Saints, like 150 kids are supposed to show up.
They really rally around that kind of a service project in their churches, so very good. Yeah.
We did have a news release that went out after the event on September 12th that mentioned the Make a Difference Day coming up. We will probably put out another news release shortly.
Yes, and it's on parkhero.org, which is our site that we recruit volunteers through. And so you can look up and see where you'd like to make everybody reports here, and then you spread out to your different sites and do your thing. And so I know Karen works jointly with the City of Vancouver.
Their
volunteer coordinator, and it's a great effort. So.
We could also use the park email distribution list that has more than 5,000 addresses on it.
That'd be great.
Yes.
That'd be awesome.
Any questions for us?
I have one just. Who is the Clark County Conservation Resources Director? Does that fall under the
it's got to be DES.
Department of Environmental Services.
Pat could answer that. The director. Yeah. I don't know. There's Dan. He's not a director. He's Conservation's Futures.
Conservation. You mean Columbia Land Trust? You're not talking to Dan Roy, right?
No. He's with Columbia Land Trust. I don't know.
Okay. I'm just curious.
There's an independent conservation district too, and that might be, I'm not quite sure what you're referring to.
Well, maybe that, yeah, I just don't know who sort of in the county realm oversees that component of the.
Well, Pat Lee is the legacy lands manager, and he's with the Department of Environmental Services. Okay. And
met Pat Lee.
If you want to, he was here.
And so Don Benton is the director of DES.
Okay,
so it's under Don Benton's
department. Yes.
Just trying to mentally map out how you all work sometimes.
So I work pretty closely with Pat Lee. He's basically taking care of all the conservation futures lands or legacy lands, and then I take care of the park lands, and then of course there's that nexus between us.
But we manage some of his properties.
We manage. We provide the maintenance on those properties, and so with the exception of weed control, which they take care of.
Okay.
So.
Okay. All right, does anyone else have anything to add before I adjourn the meeting on behalf of Barbara? Meeting adjourned. All right.
Thank you, everybody.